Hi, welcome to Holden Village. Today is Tuesday, June 18th, 1996. In the Creekside Room this afternoon, our speaker is Dan Spencer, continuing his series, Ethics and the Earth. Today's session is number 2 and is entitled, Shaping Ecological Ethics, a Spectrum of Approaches. Let's listen in.
Encourage people to find a seat, and we'll get underway. My name is Dan Spencer, and this is the second in a week-long series called Ethics and the Earth, focusing on different issues and questions in ecological ethics, and how we might begin to think about them. I have to just acknowledge a couple things. One, I have a brand new shirt. This is the first time my two nieces have had a chance to hear me teach, the Laurel and Janae in the background, and they brought me a Circle of Life t-shirt, which is fits right in with the theme for this week. So I thought, this is his debut performance as well. I thought that was pretty fun. Also, this is, for those of you who brought all your handiwork, I just have to warn you that, you know, Holden keeps encouraging us to move away from the sage on the stage model to the guide by the side. So this is going to be one of those more experiential models. So I'm going to bolt the door, you can't leave now, but you'll all have a chance at some point during the session tonight to be moving around a little bit. And it won't be touchy-feely, it won't be role-playing, but it will have a chance to help you put your body on the line as far as what you think about how we approach the issues of the ethics in the earth. As I mentioned, my name is Dan Spencer, and I currently teach religion and ethics at Drake University in Des Moines, Iowa. And one of my areas of interest and areas where I teach is the whole realm of ecological ethics and how we're facing the kinds of questions that are occurring now as technology, expanding use of resources, growing human populations, these kinds of things are confronting us with new questions. But yesterday we started to do that by introducing the whole notion of ecological ethics and what we mean by that. And I'll review that pretty briefly tonight. And then began to gain some critical self-awareness by starting to develop our own environmental autobiographies. That is, how the ways our families and our communities' histories have been shaped, in turn have shaped us and disposed us to view the world in different ways as a way to begin to understand the ways we think about issues. Tonight we're going to build on that by beginning to look at what are some of the foundational questions in environmental ethics that different and that set the framework of approaches, and we'll give you a chance to think through what your own beliefs, values, and assumptions are with respect to three grounding questions, and I'll mention those in a minute. And then the rest of the week we'll take a deeper look at four of these different models. Tomorrow we'll look at the dominant tradition that comes out of Judaism and Christianity. That is the notion of stewardship ethics, that we are on earth to be God's stewards of creation as the primary agents in that. On Thursday, we'll look at some very different models that de-center humanity in terms of the centrality. One called bioregionalism that says that human beings need to adapt their culture, our culture, to the regions in which we live and the natural flows and processes within them. And then deep ecology is a form of ecological thinking that says human-centeredness itself is the problem. We need to rethink and decenter humanity from the stage in terms of looking at these issues. On Friday, I'll show a video on ecofeminism. We'll have a chance to talk about how many women, the struggles of feminism and the struggles of ecology are coming together in an emerging field known as ecofeminism with a lot of very interesting insights. So that's a little bit of the week here. Let me just go very briefly over some of the things we talked about yesterday so we're all on board with some of the similar things. I'm calling this week a look at ecological ethics, and both sides of this term are important to understand a little bit. Now, some of you were with us, with Mary Carlson and I, me last week when we did biomedical ethics. And a very simple definition, I think, for helping us get on board with what we mean by ethics is thinking that ethics is reflection on who we are and how we act in light of who we say we want to be and how we think we ought to act. Okay? So ethics is thinking about who we are, and sometimes if you were to study ethics, you would be studying things like character ethics. You study teleological ethics, deontological ethics, consequences ethics. Those are fancy words for this little definition here. Character ethics is the who we are, what forms our basic character, our basic posture and stance in the world. How we act, do we act primarily according to the duties that we owe to each other? That's another way of saying deontological ethics. Or should we think more about the consequences of our actions, the ends that we're trying to reach? That's teleological ethics in a nutshell. It gets a little more complicated, but that gives you some sense. But the important thing is that human communities create standards. We create values, we create principles, we create norms by which we can evaluate our actions and our posture in the world. And that's what ethics does. Ecological ethics says we're doing this in a broader framework now, with what kind of impact we have on ecosystems and our environment. So how we act and who we are in a no longer in simply the human community, but the broader ecological realm. Now, some of the components, we talked about each one of us having an ethical makeup that's kind of parallel or similar to what we can call a moral scape. Now, a landscape is the kind of painting where you both stand back to take the whole thing in, but you can also move much closer and see in each individual part and how they work together. And who we are as moral beings is very similar. We have a whole makeup that each one of us in unique ways, but we have different components. And yesterday we were focusing quite a bit on the first two, and we'll look at them again tonight. One is simply our worldview, our overall worldview, which is the framework of assumptions out of which we operate. And by and large, our worldviews tend to be unconscious until they conflict with something else. If any of you have ever traveled in another country, another place, where the assumptions of the culture were different than where you're used to, you know what this means. Suddenly, everything that you assume is natural isn't working anymore, and you have to learn a different framework of assumptions. That's how worldviews function. We want to look at what are some of those grounding assumptions tonight, because they shape approaches to ecological ethics. Closely related to worldviews are our loyalties. These are our affective influences, what we love or desire, to which we give our primary allegiance. And they take the form of things like our religious faith, our family, our home community, our nation. The different kinds of communities and makeups to which we give our primary allegiance. So when we're faced with conflicting decisions, these help us to make decisions about where to devote scarce energy and time. And yet, loyalties can also lead us astray if they're poorly chosen. And the Bible, our biblical faith, Christian faith, is very full of talking about misplaced loyalties as being idolatry or wrongly placed things. You can't worship God and money. So what our loyalties are can be very helpful to try and make these conscious to understand whether they're adequate or not. When you get past both of these operating primarily in the unconscious realm, then we have norms, values, virtues, which are more specific guides. Principles, values, virtues that can give us more specific guide in any situation. And we'll be looking at more of those later in the week. And then important for ecological ethics are the experiential and the empirical elements. Experience simply means our life experience, the kind of experiences we've had. Many of us can look back and say, it was when the first time I did garbology at Holden Village, that's when I realized, da 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 da, some kind of important formational experience. But also empirical elements, like scientific studies. It may be the first day you read the picked up the newspaper and read about the ozone layer problem. It's like, whoa, something's got to change. Science is telling us more about the world today than we ever knew before. So these are some of the background things that form how we think about ethics. And then ecological ethics simply looks at what's our current context of how we move and act within a context where increasingly human actions are degrading ecosystems to the point that those processes can't recover on their own. We're affecting soils to the point where once you lose a soil horizon, you can kiss that land goodbye for centuries. We're affecting water cycles, we're affecting the air cycle, deforestation. These kinds of things that by and large, if the impact is minor, can absorb it and correct themselves. But at a certain point, the impact becomes large enough or toxic enough, it can't recover. And that's what we're talking about in terms of an ecological crisis. The decline and the loss of ecological integrity, or this ability for the ecosystem to sustain themselves due to human actions. Questions, comments on any of that so far? That's a pretty quick review of some of the things we talked about yesterday. what I'd like to do tonight is focus, as I mentioned, on three foundational questions that ethicists and philosophers have been debating, talking about in terms of, if these are the problems, what's the best way to approach them? How should we begin to think about them? And let me mention three questions that have been important. Ethicists, theologians, philosophers oftentimes talk about our community of accountability. To whom are we accountable when we think through our ethics, our theology? Good example, if you're doing Lutheran theology, your primary accountability is to the Lutheran community, the Lutheran church. That shapes the way you do things, okay? Well, ethicists are beginning to ask the question, now when we think about environmental ethics, what should be our primary community of accountability? Should it be the human community, or should it be all of life? That is, do we focus on a human-centered approach? The things that we need to maintain a healthy environment so human communities can flourish? Or are we talking more about ecosystems themselves and all of life? And there's a lot of debate about what should be the primary focus on that. We'll have a chance to think more about that. Should ecological ethics be human-centered or all of life-centered? That's one broad area of questions. The second one is one that has been very much at play always within human-centered ethics. Do you focus primarily on the rights and needs of individuals or the rights and needs of communities? Now, in Western society, we have tended to focus more on the rights of individuals. We have a Bill of Rights that protects individual rights. Socialist or communist countries have tended to focus more on the well-being of the community. But as we're going to see, this same debate takes place in ecological ethics as well, when we start to think about where should our primary attention be placed. So that's a second grouping of questions. And the third has more to do with what kind of approach should we use to successfully confront the problems. Should we work within the systems we currently have in place, the cultural values, the current systems, and reform them from within? So that our current systems, by and large, are pretty good, but we need to reform some of the bad parts of them. Or is the system itself the problem? Is our political, economic system, are our cultural values, are our religious values, are they the source of the problem? And therefore, reforming them is kind of like turning around and walking backwards on a train that's going 100 miles an hour this way towards a cliff. Reforms aren't needed. We need a wholesale transformation. We need to stop and go the other direction. That's a big debate. We sometimes talk about as reform versus radical ecology. So as a way of getting at these here, I'd like to use a little exercise that Jim Martin Schramm first put together called spectrum approaches to these questions. And I've got three of them, so I'd like to divide the room roughly into sort of three groups here. Maybe we can have the folks sitting in the first row here and the two of you, if you'd be willing to be part of the first grouping here. What I need are two other people who are willing to be readers. And let me explain before I ask you to get up. This is a very similar, a lot of you have done these values continuum kind of thing. We're going to have two readers, one on either side of the room, who are going to read a conversation to each other. And the rules are very simple. If when you're standing up here, you'll start in the middle. If you agree with what somebody says, move towards it. If you really like it, if you're in total agreement, go over and stand next to that person, put your arm around them, keep them company. If you don't really like what they've said, move away. If you find yourself repulsed by it, get all the way over to the other side of the room. But listen to this conversation of kind of two endpoints of these questions here, and see if you can locate yourself. And you may find that there are good points on both sides. But you'll have a chance to go back and forth. There'll be several different pieces of conversation before we ask you to locate yourself. So I have a couple folks who are willing to read the endpoint positions. I just need someone who can read very slowly, clearly, so people can hear, that aren't from that first group. Susan, someone else? Chris, would you be willing to do it on this one here? You'd stand over here. You stand over here. Actually, I'm going to switch you around. If you would switch opposite sides here.
Don't seat over your hurt.
So who has position number one there? Such as Susan?
Let me start.
Yes, yeah, so if you've got number one. And then Chris, wait, oh, I'm sorry, we need the rest of our people up here. So those who were named in the first group, if you would come up at this point.
start in the middle.
Start in the middle.
I naturally start over on the left.
Okay.
Yeah, but is it the left facing this way or is it the left facing this way?
When I look at the environmental mess we've gotten ourselves into, I think a big part of the problem is our attitudes toward other forms of life. We don't really appreciate or value the diversity of life forms. I've come to believe that all forms of life are of equal value, and that until society believes that, we aren't going to be able to resolve the environmental crisis.
Okay, if you agree with that, move towards it. If you disagree, move away. Chris?
Well, I agree with your concern for the environment, but I disagree with your views of other forms of life. There's a basic difference between human life and all other forms of life. It is obvious to me that a human life is more valuable than the life of a mosquito.
Do I keep talking?
Well, wait, just give people a chance to see if they agree or disagree. If you agree, move towards it. Disagree,
well, I certainly agree on mosquitoes.
But then, what if we take 3rd position?
You don't have a chance to explain your 3rd position. You might be standing over there at some point. That's always one of the dilemmas.
Christian, I knew you'd say that. In your mind, everything has to be subordinated to humanity. But I believe that all forms of life have intrinsic value, value for their own sake, not just for how important they might be for human beings. We should care about the plants in the rainforest for their own sake, not merely because they might someday be useful to us.
That was better. You were better this time.
Confused.
Okay.
Gotcha.
Susan, I can agree with you that all forms of life have some value. But that doesn't mean everything has equal value. Different forms of life have different levels of value. Are you telling me that if you had cancer and a plant in the rainforest held the cure, that you would not want someone to harvest it? In a world of many human needs, we have a right, even a duty, to intervene in nature to make life better for humans. When there is a conflict between humans and other forms of life, we should side with humans.
That's the attitude that's at the base of our problems, Christian, thinking that nature exists for our sake. Humans should only intervene in nature to satisfy our basic human needs, and we need to rethink what those really are. We have no right to destroy other forms of life just to satisfy our greeds, our gluttonous appetite of desires. The human species is one species among all the others, part of an interdependent whole, and we are all of equal value.
Frozen. All right, Christian?
Well, we're back where we started, Susan. And I still don't believe that all creatures and species are equal. Our rational and moral powers set us apart from all other species. We are the only creatures that can transcend instinct in order to choose whether to do good or evil to another creature. For this reason, there is a qualitative difference between the value of human life and all other forms of life.
I agree with you that human beings have some outstanding abilities, including you, Christian, abilities that are superior to those of other animals. But other animals also have abilities far superior to ours, such as flying, or the hearing ability of whales. Isn't it convenient and a bit self-serving that we choose the qualities we do best and construct a hierarchy of values that places us at the top? But it's just this tendency towards hierarchical thinking that gets us into these problems in the first place.
Okay, that's your spectrum of things. Does anybody want to reshuffle your position here? Are you standing about where you think you'd like to be?
Yeah, it must have been on my body odor. They just kept moving.
All right, let's start with some folks on the end points here, and then we'll move towards the middle. Tell us a little bit, why are you standing where you are?
I haven't swung either way, but I would tend to be on the left side of the line. Mm-hmm. I see the world holistically. I see us as a part of nature and a part of the creation. And I can't say I never think that we are more significant than animals or plants. I think we're significant in a different way, that we relate to the Creator in a different way. But I don't. It's not on a scale. So I'm to the left because I see us as a part of the whole.
Okay. That all things have some value, that include human beings, but not the only ones with value.
Right.
How about folks who are standing more on the other side there? Tell us why you placed yourself where you did.
Well, I was thinking that we are created in the image of God. Mm-hmm. I don't believe animals and life are. And that gives me much greater value. Mm-hmm. Gives human beings much greater value.
So there is a qualitative difference, distinction in that sense, in the way we're created.
Yeah, I would agree with that. That I mean, I like to view things holistically, too, in terms of the importance of all of these things. I don't think they should be destroyed just for destroying them, mm-hmm. but I do feel that if you have to choose between that and the human, that you've got to choose the human side. But of course, she brought in the greed, I mean, as to what our real needs are, mm-hmm. and that's the other thing we have to consider.
How about some of you in the middle? Then Ingrid will get to your outside the spectrum here.
I guess I feel like that we have to sort of set ourselves aside a little bit because of all of the animals and all of the other species, you know, in the world. We are the ones that have the most power to affect change. And so I think that because of our ability to reason and think and to plan ahead and to look ahead, I think it's incumbent upon us and it's our duty to try to preserve, you know, all of life as we can, and yet at the same time sort of, if you will, you know, slant the table a little bit in our favor because we are the only ones that sort of have some control over what's going to be happening. And so I think in and of that, I think we have to be more on the side of the individual than we do saying that everything is equal. A mosquito or some other animals are not going to be able to affect change globally.
So, I mean, realistically, for better or for worse, we've got this power. We better exercise it responsibly. Exactly. How about folks in the more in the middle here? Barbara?
I'm hedging my bets. I gravitate toward both of them, mm-hmm. but I, as the discussion went on, I'm moving a little bit more, you know, toward Chris's position. Mm-hmm.
Carmen, how about yourself?
I wasn't particularly drawn to either position. Mm-hmm. I don't see that as the issue, I guess, this fight over. I mean, I don't think that we're equal, every species, but I'm not drawn to the idea that the reason humans are superior is because of our rational faculties. I mean, we've seen what that has done. So I didn't agree with your last thing, and I would move more this way than that. I view it more as the image of God. Relationally, and I think we have to remember that we share the same day of creation with all the other mammals, the sixth day, so that we are mammals too. So I don't know. I wasn't drawn to either one.
Okay, that's fine. There may be things that are both appealing and unappealing in either one of these perspectives. You may not find yourself agreeing with either of them.
I want to be in a different continuum.
You'll have a chance here. Ingrid, what about yourself?
I just think we're all on the same side. That the important thing is salvation. Is health and preservation and life of all forms of life. We're included there.
Mm-hmm. Were there other views that people had as you were watching this, or things, questions you had? You can always have a seat here, yeah. Susan, Chris, would you have been where you were standing, or would you have been in a different spot?
I find Christian so compelling. No, I would have come toward Christian a little bit, I think, but I wouldn't have crossed the line.
Mm-hmm. You may find that some of the ways that are being phrased are not at all helpful or appealing to you, but there is a fairly broad debate in this whole area between the spectrum of what we could call, on the one side, anthropocentrism. Or human-centered. Versus biocentrism. Or all life-centered in that sense. And part of the way that this has been discussed sometimes is traditionally, most things outside the community have been valued for what we call instrumental value, that value they have to the human community. So animals, plants, other things, the value that we have ascribed to them has been whether or not they provide value to us. We talk about productive lands, being lands that are giving something to the human community. Unproductive lands are somehow not be provided for the human community. And so most traditional ethics in the West has been anthropocentric. Right? That a lot of that's being challenged now by other communities, particularly some indigenous communities and other traditions that have said, no, the whole ecosystem, the whole community of plants and animals and life itself all have value. And the question then becomes, is it an end point on the biocentric, like deep ecology would claim that all forms of life have equal degree of intrinsic value, that all forms of life have equal right to live and flourish. Then you've got other folks who will be more graded. We'll look at people in the stewardship ethics, for example, James Nash and Douglas John Hall, who will say, no, all forms of life have value. We see that in the Genesis accounts, but human beings have more value. And so they're not in a purely anthropocentric, that is a total utilitarian perspective, but they're also not in an equal egalitarian, what they call sometimes biotic egalitarianism, or all forms of life equal value, but somewhere in between having a graded degree of value. Susan and Martha?
I'm just wondering how bio gets interpreted here. What happens to rocks? Are those considered life-centered? Do they have intrinsic value?
It varies quite a bit. The many Native American traditions see rocks as having spirit and having value in that sense. There are other folks who are explicitly life-centered, and so they would not consider a rock to have intrinsic value in that sense. They still say that they should be respected. But that in the same way that you would not use up natural resources irresponsibly, but would not be seen as valuable. So what you'll see is a real spectrum in all of these here.
So my question really is there a word, a phrase beyond biocentrism that includes...
Yes.
Some people talk about geocentric, some people talk about ecocentric.
And eco involves more.
Eco involving the whole ecosystem, that might be a more helpful phrase to put there, although most of the debate has taken place within along this spectrum here between different forms of life. And we'll begin to see how these cut out into different issues as we go along here. What I want to do is get the three spectrums up here. What begins to be very interesting is as you start drawing from different endpoints in each of the three, they help us begin to understand the different positions within the debates here. We'll begin to understand, like, the spotted owl controversy, how the different camps locate themselves and why. Okay, go, Martha.
I just had one comment when I was watching people go back and forth. I mean, I would kind of lean towards the biocentric, but it gets back to, I mean, I do feel like everybody, all forms of life have equal value, but when you get back to how you want to act versus how you do act, you get to that survival mode, and, if the mosquito's biting me, I'm going to swat it, kind of attitude. And so it's like my belief system is, I believe they all have value, but when you get to reality and how you want to survive, I feel like I have the most value. Mm-hmm. Do you understand?
Mm-hmm. And part again about what we're talking about ethics then is what is the kind of moral vision you want to guide us in versus the reality of our behavior? And is that moral vision realistic, practical? Do we need to rethink it? That's part of what ethicists are trying to constantly get us to. What are our values? How closely do we adhere to them? Why? Those kinds of things. Well, let's get another spectrum up here. If actually we can get the back row folks to stand in the middle, do we have a couple people from the middle, second row, who would be willing to be readers here? Martha, would you be a reader? If you can get after you, Martha, you can come up to the next one. Put Ashley, if you'll stand over there and you'll stand over here. Again, some of the things you may agree with, some you may disagree with, but in terms of the overall spectrum, where would you find yourself? Position number one.
Do you remember the heroic efforts that were made a few years ago to save two whales that were trapped under the ice in Canada? I can appreciate the concern that was demonstrated, but in terms of environmental ethics, I think it was misplaced. We should be more concerned about maintaining the health of the ocean ecosystem than those whales depend on, instead of becoming fixated on the plight of those two individual whales.
Clumping.
Diane. Martha, you're right that we should be concerned about the health of the ecosystems that support all forms of life. But I disagree with you that protecting those ecosystems is more important than the individual lives of those creatures that live within them. The thought that we should not have tried to save those whales is morally repugnant.
Diane, I appreciate your moral sensitivity, but with respect to environmental ethics, I think it's based on a misguided sentimentality. We have limited resources available, and we need to focus them on keeping the whole ecosystems and habitats healthy, rather than on particular individual animals within them. I think that whenever individual creatures or species act in ways that undermine the health and integrity of an ecosystem, they can and should be limited, and in some cases, eliminated for the greater ecological good, and that includes human beings. It has become clear that there are far too many of us, and our numbers are destroying the ecological well-being of the planet.
Mm. Yes. Yeah, you got your work cut out.
Whoa! I want a new paper. There's a term for your position. And it's called environmental fascism. We must never try to protect the common good by abandoning individual rights. I think that the best way to protect the integrity of ecological systems is precisely by protecting the environmental rights of all creatures. Sacrificing the lives and rights of individual creatures for the sake of the whole is never morally acceptable, whether those creatures are human or other animals.
I'm sorry.
Wait, Mark, wait just a second.
Okay.
I'm having trouble.
I'm sorry, Diane, but I disagree. The survival of the planet's ecosystem is more important than what happens to the individual creatures that live within them. The overall well-being of nature and its ecosystem as a whole is more important than the individual rights of creatures, and we must act accordingly.
Martha, your position is exceedingly dangerous. In effect, you have declared yourself God without keeping a clear focus on the moral worth of each individual creature. We become morally desensitized to all life and enter the slippery slope of trying to calculate who is worthy to survive and who is not. We have no business doing that.
I acknowledge that my position may sound strange at first, but when you think about it, it's humans who have set ourselves up as God with respect to ecosystems. Always putting emphasis on individual rights is just a way to maintain domination over the ecosystem rather than finding our appropriate place in it.
Okay, those are the two positions there. Are you happy with where you're standing?
Yeah.
All right. Well, we'll start again with the ends and move towards the consensus position here. Craig, tell us a little bit why we're where you are.
Well, when I listen to both of them, I think that both of them are way too focused. Because when you start to look at individuals, whether it's the whales or one species, I mean, the efforts that were put forth to save those two whales probably did more good for the world's oceans than if we had spent that money doing something else. You know, because it aroused the emotions of people, and all of a sudden they came together, and it was different countries, and now we could work together on this, we could do all sorts of things.
There is something about our moral sensitivity, the response to individual plight. So there is something that says the moral value of individuals, we respond when we see, like the little girl who slips down the well. You know, there may be 50,000 people starving someplace else, but one little girl falls down a well, so the attention of the world is focused. There's something about the individual moral sensitivity is important. But you're saying that it needs to be a balance between those, right?
Because I don't think you can just ignore individual rights, and yet, but it's, sometimes it's, you know, what I can do might be just a little individual thing, but it, if we all do that little individual thing, it's going to make a big difference.
Hmm. David and Karen, you're on this sort of more in the middle ground here. Why you are where you are?
I guess it has something to do with that slippery slope kind of thing, or that that if, I don't know, can you completely give up on individuals, whether it's humans or you know, certain animals in a species, just for the good of whatever? That all seems kind of nebulous to me.
I think that the problem I have with respecting the rights of the individual is that in human society as it's organized right now, the individuals with more means tend to get more weight. So not all individuals are weighted equally. Mm-hmm. That's the big problem I have with it. But I stayed on this end because I thought the incident with the whales could be a very strategic play of the media to focus on the plight of the oceans, mm-hmm. number one. And secondly, at the very end, the issue of who deems to determine the collective rights. So I stayed on this end of the collective spectrum.
Well, let's move over to Jeff and Chris are standing over closer to us. Martha's in there.
Well, I believe that that we need to take some radical steps, and I think we, for example, speed limits in the United States, I think we have to decide that 55 is better, and it isn't individual rights, and we don't. I think there has to be a kind of fascism about certain things like that, because the benefits are so much greater than the losses of individual rights. I think that people are incapable in some ways of making those kinds of decisions on their own in a rational and helpful way. And eventually, decisions are forced on us by, you know, by the soil blowing away. Everybody in Oklahoma has to move. Because the soil blew away because people didn't.
So unless you have a minimum healthy ecosystem, there's no grounding for individual rights.
Right. Everything gets lost.
So that's the primary. Yeah. Chris, would you agree or?
Yeah, I think it's really important to have a view of the system and the way things work together. And without that vision, like without a vision for the whole creation in Genesis 1, we don't have any context for our own place and value, and therefore our responsibilities to the rest. Mm-hmm. So I think that's really important. Plus I think that, David was talking about this, that the particular value that gets placed on an individual can be completely skewed on the basis of whatever our value is. And a really brief example, I was youth director of a church in Oakland. Well, I was an intern pastor, but I worked with the youth last year. And there's a highly publicized place of a young girl who was kidnapped and then murdered in the Bay Area, Polly Class. And it's getting all sorts of press. It's at trial now. And it's an African-American church that I was serving, and one of the young teenage boys in my class said, "I can't believe how much attention that trial gets. There's murders of African Americans every day in Oakland, and they barely get a paragraph in the newspaper, and they're horrendous. He said, if Polly Klass was black, that wouldn't have got any attention at all. And so that's an example, I think, of what happens when particular individuals are the basis on which people act and their emotions are.
And you can really miss the whole systemic nature of injustice as well. Yeah, like
exactly.
Individual action.
Exactly. So that drew me over here.
How about other folks who haven't had a chance to talk? Carol, Gertrude, Bill, get anything else to add or where you are?
Well, I go back to the beginning of creation where, and I've objected to the words man's created, subdue. I want to say tend the earth. Mm-hmm. And that way, if we would do what it says of tending the earth, we'd be taking care of both. Because it's necessary to give life, new life if you can, even to the plant and animal, is experimentation. But it gets lopsided because the wealthy get the preference of what's being done. But I think if we did what it says in Scripture, tend the earth, we'd have a balance of all of it.
Mm-hmm.
We missed the point of that.
I'm this far toward this end because I truly believe that, for one thing, I'm strongly in favor of the population statement that was made. And I have conflicts when it comes to people. I'm quite content to allow the natural world to proceed naturally, hopefully without humans screwing it up. But I have trouble with it. I find myself moving that way every time she mentions taking care of individual humans. So that kind of surprised me. I didn't know I felt quite so strongly that way. But I found myself drawing a parallel between the taking care of those whales and our concern with the mama deer and baby deer in Holden Village, mm-hmm. and our worries that the bears are going to eat up the babies. That's, you know, it's very much a part of the natural mm-hmm. balance of mm-hmm. this area. And we find ourselves sometimes wanting to go out and just gather up all the mamas and babies and bring them into Holden where they're safe. and that would be incorrect. We would be creating a poor balance that way.
Let me let you all sit down for a minute here and just talk a little bit more about this second bit. I actually had folks in opposite sides of where I wanted, but I mean, it's fairly clear, I think. Again, we got a spectrum here. My guess is that most of us would say it needs to be a balance between these. I mean, you need both attention, both individual and holistic emphases in there. But what I want to do is start giving you some of the end points, because we're going to see how these work together to create different environmental positions here. And this whole, I think we have tended to operate very much in this country primarily focusing on the individual. And only as Jeff pointed out, only when we have conflicts like gas shortages and stuff do we enter into the holistic side there. But at what point do ecological limits begin to impose themselves and force us to think more in those lines there? Yeah. Any comments or thoughts on this sort of spectrum of positions here? Anne, are you?
Well, I guess one thing is that I think one problem is our knowledge on the holistic is so weak.
Mm.
That sometimes we don't know exactly enough to really shift all the way that mm-hmm. way. And that sometimes the individual effects of things are, you know, it's like the canary in the mine shaft.
Yeah. Yeah.
And so that's the thing that makes me a little uneasy about the holistic, because mm-hmm. if we start saying, well, we're going to let some individuals go because we feel this is the way holistically we hold the whole system yeah. together, I'm not sure we always know.
Well, it's very, it can be a real slippery slope. Who do you let go? Who has value? These kinds of
yeah,
things, too.
Yeah, and so it is, I think it's both.
That's where, I mean, the one side there, you know, has said, that's ecological fascism, when you start imposing a whole that way. Who decides who's no longer worthy of being preserved, these kinds of
yeah.
issues.
Yeah.
You
know?
I think, you know, the bumper sticker that says think globally and act locally, mm-hmm. to me, that it addresses that exact issue, that mm-hmm. we have to think as a part of a whole world community. I think it's good that we have a spectrum of ideas, because then we balance each other. Not no single individual has the right idea. None of us have the answer. And the Lord made us creative so that we can work together and figure that out. but that if we think holistically, but we act in our space, this is our environment, we act in our environment, we affect that environment, help where we can and contribute where we can.
Okay, good point. Susan?
Well, maybe a sister reiteration. I see that holistic as so obviously the right position from my point of view, except when it comes to the human community. And then I begin saying, so my dad's 74, he's non-productive. What? Are we done with him? So my child isn't very bright and will never be really independent. So is it better for the whole? I mean, that's when the individual, that's when I guess something else rises up in me, and I want to say intrinsically, even non-productive human beings have a value in the whole, even though I think, I mean, do we carry cards now to limit the number of kids like they do in China? So that you have.
I'm gonna move us along because I want to. What I say, but you're raising the very difficult issues because what is precisely when we absent humans from this that we start running into the problems. I mean, you just think on the other hand, think about some of the Inuit communities where when you reach a certain age point in life, it was your duty, your moral duty, to die. And that, I know, it's a Barbara.
You don't know my dad.
Where I would look over here more was I think was the second comment on this end was, I would say, bad science even. I mean, this sort of utilitarian that we can make systems operate when any species gets out of sync with that, then it's sort of our duty to weed them out. So, I mean, that nature is much more whimsical and abundant, stingy in some ways, but that was not, I don't think, that position was not completely unimaginative, quite repulsive and inaccurate scientifically. The way that change happens, catastrophically in so many ways in nature, it just isn't this, that was a...
It's mechanistic.
Yeah, it was a mechanistic, exactly.
Mm-hmm. That's a good point. I think that particular statement needs to be reworked. I agree.
I want to share something I ran into today that really speaks to both of these spectrums. I was reading something that Pedro Casaldáliga from Brazil said when asked about whether the environmental movement might be a way of bringing together people from the United States and those who were struggling for justice in Brazil. And he said, only if it is concerned about the position of the poor in the rainforest, as well as the plants and the other. I think that there's a sense in which the holistic or the anthropomorphic works if we, as powerful Westerners, commit ourselves to operating within a global family where we might find some of the insights about the position of the rainforest or the trees. Or, that's not going to come from Western culture so much as it is the Native Americans or the indigenous in the rainforest. So we can trust a more anthropocentric model if we commit ourselves to some kind of holistic position within the global community.
Excellent point. What I want to do is get the last spectrum up here and then start to see how they begin to combine precisely on those kinds of points there when you're reading up there. So if anybody who hasn't had a chance to stand in the middle yet, if you'd come up, if we can get a couple other readers here. Laurel and Janae, you're welcome to come up if you like. Barbara, would you be a reader here too? Barbara Rawson, yeah. You've been up in the middle already, right?
That's not what I'm talking about. No, I don't
want to be on. We'll go through this one fairly quickly here and have a few closing comments. We'll start with this again tomorrow. So who's that number one?
I do.
Okay.
Let's face it, the world is a mess. It seems the more we try to solve things, the more we mess things up. What we need is a completely different understanding of our relationship to and place in the natural world. We will not be able to transform our ecological problems until we transform ourselves.
Can we, just one second. So, do you agree, move towards it? Okay.
Yes, we do need to be more careful and more intelligent about our relationship to nature. But we don't need some profound change in our worldview or philosophy to see what is wrong and take action. We can correct our environmentally harmful behavior by using better technologies, by updating our economic theories,
and by passing better governmental regulation.
Hey, go ahead.
Don't get me wrong. I'm not saying that we shouldn't take action where we can, but even these actions will inevitably be flawed until we change some of our basic assumptions about our relationship to the world. For example, we need to get rid of our false notion that neatly separate mind from body, subject from object, and human nature from the rest of nature. We need to cast off our false myth of independence from nature and accept our true interdependence with all other forms of life.
It is true that our narrow anthropocentric perspective has caused enormous harm. We are deeply indebted to people like you who stress the interdependence of all life forms. I think we are beginning to understand how we as human beings are dependent on other forms of life and how we need to take care of them in order for us all to live. It's clear that we need to be better stewards of the earth than we have been.
Forgive me, but your stewardship model assumes precisely the paternalistic attitude that we need to reject and avoid. It flows out of a mindset that is patriarchal and hierarchical, that always has someone or something on top of somebody or something else, managing and controlling things for the good of those underneath. Historically, that's meant men in charge of women, one race in charge of another, owners in charge of workers. Here it's humans on top of nature. Many of us think that this attitude is the underlying root of not only eco-crisis, but also racism, sexism, and class exploitation. Until we demolish this foundation of patriarchy, all our efforts will only exacerbate the eco-crisis.
Whoa. That was a pretty fast jump from stewardship to patriarchy. The point is, we don't have a lot of time for philosophical introspection and creating a whole new culture. Unless we act quickly and wisely in the next 10 to 20 years, the ecological systems that support life on Earth will collapse. We don't have the luxury to spend so much time reflecting on why we are in this mess. We need to direct our energies towards how we can get out of it. For better or worse, given the enormity of the problems that face us, this means working now within the system we already have in place and using the technology and political power already available to us.
Everyone agrees that we have to act now, immediately, but working within the system is no answer. The system itself is the problem. It's what has caused our current problems. We might be able to limit some of the damage in the short term by working within the system, but the only effective long-term solution will require a total transformation of both the system and the culture that supports it.
Okay, that's the spectrum there. Happy with where you're standing? All right, let's start over here with Dean and tell us why you're standing where you are and we'll move to the other side of here.
It's a good question. I don't know, it's hard to balance those two questions, but it seems like, especially in view of recent archaeological information, that it seems to me inevitable that humans in the nature of our existence will influence the environment, and trying to find some balance between that, the recent digs in, I forget what it is, Kansas, southwestern the U.S., show that it's asserted, at least in some perhaps rather controversial things, that they were responsible for the demise of the mammoth, woolly mammoth. But it seems like if we are going to live, we will have some impact on our surroundings, and so we have to be with the system as much as possible, but it may not be possible to always be not in the system if we're in the system.
Okay, Martha?
Boy, I guess I was leaning more this way, and coming from a realist point of view is that I can't see us changing that drastically, and yet I really do feel like we're on a timeline for destruction, and that we need to use whatever we got, whether or not it's new technology, government regulation, or whatever, to help kind of improve the planet. And I kind of felt like, don't throw the baby out with the bathwater. I mean, there's a lot of problems, and it's obvious that we've had a lot of problems, but it's what we've got. And
time is short. Be realistic.
Exactly.
Do what we got.
Exactly.
How about some of the folks who are more on the other side over here, Gary and Ann?
I like the idea that we have to change our way of looking at the world and look at ourselves as embedded in nature. And for myself, I used to think of myself as living beyond my death, but recently I looked at just the ecological development of life on the planet. So I have this definite sense that I'm finite with the planet, and that it can die, or the planet can die, and I'm going to die, and so things are a lot more fragile in some respects than I thought they were. So it's just a different way of looking at, especially the view of the world that science has given us now. It seems like it's quite a bit different from, say, the Christian tradition or some of the religious traditions. So it's trying to correlate those two and take things that are worthy out of both.
So we really have some new understandings. I mean, we've got to rethink and really transform some of our older ways of thinking.
Uh-huh.
Yeah, or any of the others in here?
In some ways, I have some faith that some of the practical things are going to happen without us, the people, that it is becoming more broad, widely accepted that there have to be some of the practical changes made. And so I think we, in some ways, have the luxury to do some real basic thinking. And I think maybe it's really a middle course in a way, but I think we, in the long term, we really do have to rethink in a drastic way. But I don't think that forecloses the fact that some of these practical things are going to continue to go on. I think the balance is already that way, so we can afford to maybe make some more radical changes.
Anyone else up there have anything they would add to what's been said? Or you?
Yeah, I do. When I was thinking about this, I never really thought that I would be on this radical end. I guess I've always felt like I would think that institutions in place would do the job, but I was thinking about my own experience of living in the inner city, because I was talking about it earlier tonight, and it seems like people don't really affect change there until they're really uncomfortable, and something's making them uncomfortable. And I think it seems like in our society, that people haven't gotten uncomfortable enough yet with, because they're not really in touch with what they're doing because of the way we live. They don't see that what goes down the drain ends up 6 miles away here. And so it seems to me that there has to be something radical to increase that awareness.
Radical in the sense of really getting to the root of things in that sense.
Right.
We're nearing the end of our time. I have a couple minutes to start to wrap. If you all want to take a seat, this last one here, as you can see, and Barbara, thanks and Charlie for the meeting there, is this whole debate about whether reform and working within our systems, whether they're political economic systems, or really a radical transformation is the way to begin to think about things. Anyway, as you start to begin to combine some of these, for example, I would say that capitalism, by and large, is extremely anthropocentric. It focuses on only human beings as having value. Everything else exists as a product or a resource. And it focuses on maximizing individuals. If you satisfy individual desires, that's what makes things tick. And so you can locate people who choose to work within capitalism then would be working within a radical or reform model of individual, focus on the individual and human-centered as one in that area there. I'd say we're going to look at deep ecology later in the week. Deep ecology argues strongly for intrinsic value in all of life, so it's strongly biocentric. It's strongly holistic. It argues in terms of ecosystems and our place within them. And it argues for a radical transformation of the current systems, things we have here. So you can locate a deep ecology position over in here. Now let me ask you a question here. Where would you locate the Humane Society? What does the Humane Society try to do?
Save
animal lives, okay? And so is it anthropocentric or biocentric?
I think it's anthropocentric.
I'm hearing both here.
It saves animals that people love, and it's very individualistic.
It's clearly individualistic. It's focusing on the welfare of animals. Does it give value to animals for their own sake?
Yes.
I'm hearing both here. At the very least, it's taken extension of human values and saying, okay, we need to at least have care and treatment. So it may be located somewhere in here.
Yeah.
Okay.
Actually, I think they've updated themselves. We heard a guy from the Humane Society speak at this conference I was at, and they're very much now into ecosystems.
I think they're close to the biocentric.
They are.
Okay. I would say Humane Society, you could argue, is biocentric and individual. Yeah. Now, are they reform or radical? Are they advocating transforming the system or making our system better? Making the system better, by and large. Humane Society, you can locate that as a biocentric, individual reform thing. Now, contrast that with PETA, People for the Ethical Treatment of Animals. Also concerned for animals, the rights of animals. But here's an example of one that's biocentric, individual, because they focus on the rights of individual animals. But it's talking about, really, ending of animal industry, ending of consuming animals. I mean, they're talking about transforming the system. So when you look at the difference between the Humane Society and PETA, part of what you're going to see is their primary difference is located, one's working within the system to reform it, and one is working to transform the system. We'll be talking about tomorrow's stewardship. And I'll argue a little bit, I think that stewardship has primarily started as human-centered, humans as the primary ones, but increasingly is moving towards recognizing value elsewhere. Stewardship, by and large, is holistic. It recognizes value in the whole without sacrificing individual rights, but it has a holistic frame. And the question then, of course, becomes, is it primarily reform or radical in its transformation? And there we'll see a spectrum in Jewish and Christian communities within that. So we'll be talking a little bit more about how to locate different positions within this framework. But it's one way for us to begin to think about why different positions have different fundamental values in terms of this spectrum of viewpoints. And there are other spectrums as well. When we get to the ecofeminism video on Friday, there are just some wonderful things with all these in terms of even rethinking all this kind of framework. We need to break for Vespers. But thanks very much for your participation tonight.
Thank you.
Thank you.